I'm here just for 3 weeks on teaching staff. But I have been responsible over the last several years with my husband for putting together and coordinating the 2 weeks or 10 days, or in this case 12 days at Holden Village, called Rainbow on the Mountaintop. So I'm particularly interested in issues of multicultural nature. And I thought that since the official beginning of Rainbow on the Mountaintop, which is a sort of multicultural celebration, is Wednesday, that Monday would be a fun time to talk about white as a color of the rainbow, that Northern European white folks are part of Rainbow on the Mountaintop, but that sometimes we make assumptions about who we are that that are kind of off-putting for some other people. That when we sort of assume that we're the standard and they should be like us, or they should measure up to whatever we do, or, you know, there's some. I was raised in Moorhead, Minnesota, and in my community in Moorhead, Minnesota, we were mostly Norwegian Lutherans. And I'm Norwegian Lutheran, and I sort of figured we were the way everybody was. Except I knew there were some people in Moorhead who were quite different. And they were represented by my friend Georgianne Welch, who had red hair and was Catholic. So that was the extent of the breadth of my knowledge about people while I was coming up, about differences among people, is that there were some Catholics and everybody else was Norwegian Lutheran. And the Catholics were working class, by and large. And in Moorhead, the Catholics were working class, and the Norwegian Lutherans were tended to be the more successful people in town. They tended to be more middle class and have more financial success and maybe more education. So, of course, I grew up with a very set of blinders, a set of biases that I wasn't even aware of. I was a fish swimming in a school of fish, you know. Everybody seemed the same to me. And when I moved to Chicago to start teaching in the urban studies program that I'm still teaching in now, that was 20 years ago. And at that time, I made a friend whom I very much liked and was very attracted to, who was a black woman. And we kept kind of not quite making it, not quite matching as friends. We kept misunderstanding one another. And she was very hurt a lot of the time, which was a mystery to me. I adored her, just adored her. I thought she was all the things I wanted to be. She was wonderful and free and creative and fun, and she laughed. Well, I didn't want to hurt her feelings. So we finally talked enough to figure out that there were things about me, Norwegian American, Scandinavian, Lutheran, for whatever reason, Northern Minnesota, which were very shut down from her point of view, very kind of withdrawn and shut down and cold and unexpressive. And she felt rejected by me. She felt like I was mad at her all the time. My presence communicated anger. Well, I was really horrified and have spent a fair amount of time trying to not be that way, trying to overcome whatever it is that I was raised with that made me appear to lots of other people. Turned out she wasn't alone. Lots of different people thought that I was very kind of withdrawn and quiet and unemotional and cold. And here I thought I was just brimming with emotion, and, you know. And of course, in my own community, I'd been pretty obstreperous and outspoken and quite the opposite. So a few years later, I had another experience that shed some additional light on this for me. I went as a representative of the Urban Studies program that I teach for to visit two of our member campuses. And I went with somebody else who was on our faculty. The man I went with is named Hal Barron, and he's maybe 15 years older than I am, and he is Jewish, and he was raised in a large Jewish community and a Jewish family, and he's extremely expressive. You know, he uses his arms when he talks and his hands, and he's very charming and very literate, but he tends to invade people's space from my point of view. He stands too close to them. And Hal and I are dear friends, and Hal is the godparent to one of my children, in spite of his being Jewish, because he's such a wonderful fellow and has with so many qualities that we just adore. So we went to Carleton and St. Olaf, Carleton to recruit students and do campus relations and talk to faculty. Carleton and St. Olaf are two Midwest private liberal arts colleges in the same town. They're in Northfield, Minnesota, population
12,000.
At that time, probably 8,000. And Carleton is a pretty urban place. It's thought to be very intellectual and high-powered, and it attracts a lot more Jewish students and various cultures of students. St. Olaf is a bastion of Norwegian-American, Lutheran people. I mean, it's a real stronghold. I should know, two of the buildings on that campus are named after my family. I mean, that's my roots and heritage are all at St. Olaf. And so Hal and I went to Carleton and St. Olaf, and we first were at St. Olaf, and I would find myself seeing Hal across campus, standing with some faculty that we really wanted to cultivate and have them get to know us and like us because they had to send their students on our program. And I would see that he was invading their space and practically knocking their noses off with his hands, and that he was talking too loud, and I was going to rush up and quietly kind of push him back and try to tamp him down a little bit. And Hal, who was very sophisticated about these things, knew immediately what I was doing and would sort of grin and back off and lower his voice and become Norwegian insofar as it was possible for him to do. We would go 6 blocks away across town to Carleton, and if some dean or some faculty person would ask the two of us a question and I would answer, they would just not even hear me. It was as though I hadn't spoken. And they would look to Hal, and if Hal sort of gave some affirmation of what I'd said, then it was okay. And if Hal answered, they would be very responsive and they could figure out what he was saying. So he could communicate on Carleton campus in a way that I couldn't. And I could communicate on St. Olaf campus in a way that he couldn't. And so I really realized then the power of the cultural stuff that we're raised with in terms of our ability to get along in the world and to communicate and to reach out and touch other people. And so I thought, well, at the beginning of Rainbow on the Mountaintop, we ought to take a look at some things about being white and see what we can learn about our culture. The culture, of course, comes to us through our history. There's a lot you can explain in everybody's culture through their history, what's just actually happened to their people. And through their habits of life and through their necessities of life. If you've lived poor for a number of generations, it changes you. Or even if you've lived poor for a year, it changes you. So I thought I'd ask some questions about being Scandinavian Americans. I'm going to ask these questions and ask you to think about them, and then I'm going to read you a story about some out of this book, an everyday story, Norwegian Women's Fiction. This is a book of stories written by Norwegian women about all the issues women always write about, mainly family. And then we can discuss the story and we can discuss our lives. We can sort of broaden the discussion out from the story. The questions that I've just jotted down are who are we, each of us? What characteristics do each of us have? What characteristics do we have that we're proud of, that we feel real good about, that we like out of our culture, our heritage, our family? What characteristics do we have, or what do we dislike about ourselves? What makes us uncomfortable, or what aren't we sure is so good, or what did we inherit that we're not pleased about in our own heritage? Do we, as those of us who are Scandinavians, do we have a dark side? You know, my husband, who's German, always says, well, Scandinavians are dour, everybody knows that. So, you know, what about that? And how do we learn about who we are? How do you raise it to consciousness and look at it? How do you get out of being that fish swimming in a school of fish in a sea where you just can't even see how you are particularly something and not something else? And then can you become something else? Can you acquire characteristics of other people? Or am I condemned forever to never be heard on Carleton campus? So I thought it would be fun to hear this story. I got the inspiration for a whole set of things I've been doing at Holden last week and this from this book, We Are the Stories We Tell. And I thought, if there's something about telling stories that reveals a lot about who we are, then that's worth looking at. That's an interesting subject for us all. In this book, An Everyday Story, there are very few themes. There are lots of stories, but they all turn out to be, they're about women's role in society. The one I'm going to read you is the point of view is from a man who tells a story, a narrator, but they're about women's work. The oldest ones are maybe 150 years old. The one I'm going to read you was written maybe 80 years ago. They're about the roles that women play in life. How do they succeed financially? Do they, you know, the role of marriage, which is often how people succeeded financially, especially some years ago. What happens to you if you're an old maid? What kind of work can you do? How does your work turn out for you? And this particular story is asking a number of those questions. It's called A Crime. It's by someone called Nini Roll Anker. And one question to ask yourself about this story is, what is the crime that was committed? Is there a crime? Did somebody perpetrate the crime? What point of view does the narrator have? How does the narrator, who's a man, who's a friend of the family that we're going to be learning about, what does he think of the family? And what is his role in the whole thing? And then I'd like you to think that in the family there are four people. There's a father and a mother and two daughters. I'd like you to try to think, are there any all bad or all good people in this story? You know, is there anybody who's really a bad person? Or is there anybody who doesn't sort of receive a mixed set of characteristics, some bad and some good? And also that this person, although the story is translated, I'd like you to know that the person used language, I think, quite subtly, and that the language, the words that she chose to use are meaningful and they carry a lot of weight with them. So, a crime. I stopped by the day after the funeral. I felt it was my duty. We've known each other since childhood, Torvald Landsrud and I, and soon we'll have worked together in the same office for 25 years. I was also Elise's godfather. Though I paid little enough attention to her while she lived, I'm ashamed to admit. Landsrud has a way of keeping people at a distance. Not obviously, but at a distance all the same. I've often wondered exactly what it is that keeps us at arm's length from him. He's just a little fellow, not much to look at, unremarkable, you might say. But there's something about him just the same. Frankly, the people in the office are afraid of him. What is there about him? There he sits in his glass cage, taking in money, paying out money, orderly in the extreme. He'll return an account for the least error in spelling. One small letter has toppled greater men than I, he says. And it is true, isn't it? We have to give him credit, don't we? A precise and conscientious man, starched collar in place, well-groomed white beard, polite, kind to everyone. Yes, but just the same. I don't know if it's the soft voice, or the nose that is clearly too small. I've actually brooded over it many times. I think it must be the eyes. Clear blue, unblinking, expressionless eyes. I've tried to meet that gaze. I have nothing to hide, but I can never look him straight in the eye. I break out in a sweat. I just can't do it. He's so damned spotless, Landsrud is, you see, and he knows it. There's never been any talk about him or his wife or their two daughters. There's never been any gossip about them before this thing happened to Elise. So you can imagine. I'm a callous old bachelor, but the day I heard about Elise, I felt sorry for Landsrud and his family and his Free Church flock. You know how people are. Bank teller Landsrud doesn't belong to the state church. He's been an elder in his Free Church for many years. For my part, I prefer to listen to the bishop when I need bolstering. To my way of thinking, if it's going to be, let it be straight from the top, and surely the bishop is closest to our Lord. But Landsrud has gone his own way, and people have the gall to remember that, too, when misfortune strikes a man. Well, I put on my mourning gloves and went over the day after the funeral. I felt it was my duty to show Landsrud that I was his comrade in sorrow. Landsrud's have a nice home. I'd been there two or three times before. There aren't many who can say that. The Landsruds keep to themselves. They're self-sufficient folk, rare enough in our day. Anna once went to the sanatorium for her lungs, but that's been a great many years ago. It must be almost 20 years now, and she's never been anywhere else that I know of. And there was never anything wrong with Elise. Elise had been at home with her parents her entire life. When she spoke, it was like listening to Landsrud himself, though for the most part she didn't have much to say. A nice, quiet girl, you know. Earned her 200 kroner a month at Hjortals. I've bought ties and such from her many times. She clerked exactly like a machine. Never any foolishness there. No glances and curls and head tilted at an angle. It was clerk and customer to everyone, prim and proper. She wasn't Torvald Landsrud's daughter for nothing. Both she and Anna lived at home and paid for their room and board. Everything was up to snuff in that household, regular household help. It could even be called ample under the circumstances. But with the accounts in order, you can be sure. Landsrud is not one to hand out pennies before he has squeezed them. What can I say? What can I say? A nice home, nice furniture, clean and tidy, embroidery wherever one looked, and three women to look after it all. Well, there were three before Elise died. I'll never forget that morning, 2 weeks ago today, when I opened the office door and the bookkeeper came rushing up to me asking, "Have you heard the news, Jensen?" What could I have heard? I sat at home all evening, went to bed at 10 o'clock, and slept tolerably well, shaved, and ate breakfast in the morning, and went to the office without speaking to a soul. "Elise Landsrud has disappeared," said the bookkeeper. "Disappeared?" I asked. "She was going for a walk in the storm yesterday. That's what she said, at any rate. And no one has seen her since. Now they're out searching for her, Landsrud and a group of others. A minute ago, my wife called and said they'd found her hat on Kropstad's dock." I was speechless. Elise, I thought. I could see her as clearly as I had seen her the last time I bought some small item at Hjortals. The small, thin mouth that never curved upward in a smile, the sharp nose and the black eyes. Her mother has black eyes. She wasn't pretty. Beauty doesn't run in the family, but she was a nice, quiet girl. From that home, too. It was inconceivable. Well, they found her later on in the day, as you know. Her body lay in shallow water. There was an onshore breeze, and the tide had done its work. She lay smiling. Inconceivable. As I said, I went to Landsrud's after the funeral, the deceased's godfather. It was my duty. The three of them were sitting in that lovely parlor. It must have been around 6 o'clock. They stood up when I came in, black morning clothes in a nice room. It was a sad sight. Both Landsrud and his wife thanked me for coming. Anna sat locked within herself. Anna might well have thought she would go first. She was the eldest. But no one knows what she thought. She and Elise had shared a room since they were little girls, and though there were 10 years between them, they had grown more and more alike. Elise celebrated her 30th birthday the day before she disappeared. Landsrud appeared the same as always, and I couldn't look him in the eye now either when he looked at me. "You've heard what they're saying?" he asked before I had a chance to sit down. I had heard so many things. People can't say enough on such an occasion. "I never listened to loose talk, you know that," I answered. "No, not you," he said, "but there's an abundance of those who do. An occurrence such as this is a good mouthful and a real treat for the mob. They can fall upon a decent man and a happy home for their own pleasure, Jensen. Their imagination knows no bounds." Landsrud talks this way, pedantically. He's an elder in his church. My chair suddenly began to feel hard and uncomfortable. I had come to bring condolence and had intended to leave again right away. Landsrud began to pace around the table. His head was thrown back, as was his custom, as if to make him appear taller. His hands were clasped behind his back. His whiskers were freshly trimmed so you could see the skin underneath. It was as white as his beard. Mrs. Landsrud had obviously failed. She sat wringing her hands. Anna crocheted. "The police have been here," Landsrud said. "Are we to be spared nothing? We have been questioned. The rumors have done their work. We were asked if there was a man in Elise's life." "In Elise's life, Jensen, in my daughter's life." They questioned Anna, too. Anna immediately bent her head. She mumbled something. I couldn't hear what it was. Landsrud asked if I could imagine a man in Elise's life. I had to answer as I saw it. I couldn't imagine it. I was satisfied that I could truthfully say that to his comfort. Landsrud didn't raise his voice. He never raises his voice, but I could see that he was shaken and upset. I could see it by the trembling of his beard. "There, you hear it, Anna. You hear what Elise's godfather says. So how could you have so should you have answered also," he said in his customary mild tone. "I said the truth," I answered, "not as far as I know." Anna also spoke softly. Landsrud knocked on the table with his ring. "But we do know it," he said. "And you shouldn't exaggerate your truthfulness, Anna. A man? Where would he have come from? Elise went to the store at 9:10. At precisely 2:00, she hurried home by way of Storgatan and ate her dinner. And you sat with her, mother." "Every day," mumbled Mrs. Landsrud. "She took Storgatan back and worked until closing time. After supper, she took a walk around the hospital for her headache, on well-lighted streets, when we weren't in church. Where would a man come from? I've kept my little girls close to home, and the whole town knows that." I had to agree to that. "Do you know of any reason your daughter would take her own life?" they asked me. "She didn't commit suicide, Jensen. Why ever would Lisa want to do away with herself?" He didn't shout, but his voice shook. "We're happy and well contented," he said. "We've always been happy. Between these walls fall no hard words. Here rules peace and harmony. Here is a home. Our Lord and I have provided for that." Mrs. Landsrud looked up. It was the first time she had looked up since I came into the room. "I have brooded over this visit, you see. I have recalled every moment. I am not mistaken." She looked up then for the first time. She did not look at her husband. She looked at me. She has dark eyes, dark and small and not easy to read. It seemed to me that her eyes begged for forgiveness, begged my forgiveness for something. But that is an impossible idea. It was a strange look. "A crime has been committed," said Landsrud, quietly and slowly. It will probably never be solved. Jensen, our police chief, is a drunkard. Come now, drunkard? That is a strong word, Landsrud, I said. I've seen for myself how much beer is carried into that house, he answered. We see it from our window every day, as you well know. Yes, naturally, I've seen the beer wagon from the office window as well, but I'm very nearsighted, and unfortunately there's a lot I miss. Landsrud told me that Anna had seen the police chief come staggering from the club many times. You remember we've talked about it, Anna, he said, he asked. Yes, Papa, Anna answered. You remember you saw it, he asked. He wasn't steady, Anna said. There was nothing I could say. I'm an old sinner myself. The police chief won't investigate, said Landsrud. Elise has been the victim of a criminal, but now she is with God. He has taken her to him, and he alone knows how she came to him. Mrs. Landsrud folded her hands. Her tears fell on them. I wanted to get up. I didn't feel well, but Landsrud laid his hand on my shoulder and said, If you had only been here last evening, Jensen, if you had heard Elise say, Now I am 30 years and 1 day old. If you could have smelled the sweet fragrant spices from the stove and cast an eye over our little circle, you would understand that no one would desert this home of their own free will. Anna laid down her crochet work. She got up and crossed the room and opened the stove door to put a piece of wood in the stove. The red light from the glowing coals reflected on her face, a closed-in face, as I said before. Suddenly, Mrs. Landsrud spoke, or possibly she was just thinking out loud. It seemed a feeble cry from one long silent. It took me by surprise. We sat, all three of us, around the table, she said. Papa wandered around with his pipe. We talked about the Olsons down below, who are never at peace. I've reported him, Mother, Landsrud said. It's the last time he'll use our garbage cans. I don't believe she heard a word of it. She sat and rocked. Her hands had become still. She recalled that last evening, just as I have gone through this visit in my mind. I could see it in her eyes. She just went on. And you remember, Anna, you said you had seen Netta Olson come home with a fellow again. And you remember you said they turned the phonograph on in the middle of the night, and Elise cried because she couldn't get to sleep. And then Elise said, I wasn't crying. And then you said you must have heard wrong. And then Papa said that a person ought to be able to weep over their sins without witnesses. And he asked Elise to fill his pipe, and she got up and filled his pipe. And I said, You should stuff cotton in your ears at night, little girls. Then you would sleep as well as ever. Do you remember, Anna? Anna didn't answer. She was about to begin her crochet work again, but Landsrud pointed to the tongs she had forgotten to hang up, and she got up and hung the tongs back on the rack. Her mother continued. And then for tea, we ate the rest of the cake that Elise had for her birthday, and we lit as many of the candle of the 30 candles as were left and watched them burn one by one. And Lisa snuffed out the ends one by one with her spoon. Landsrud stood and looked at me. When I looked at him, he nodded. His head sat straight on his shoulders. His eyes were filled with tears. Mrs. Landsrud continued. So then Papa sat down in the rocking chair and read through the newspaper, page by page, and we sat with our embroidery and listened to the rain on the window pane. We didn't talk then because he was reading. When the church clock struck 9, Anna took out the deck of cards. We play double solitaire in the evenings, Anna and I, said Landsrud. I'm no card player, Jensen. It's just a harmless pastime. No, I know you don't play cards, I answered. Then his wife chimed in again. And when Anna took the tablecloth off the table, Elise said, Roll it up the other way, just for once. Anna looked up. She turned red, But why should she blush? Her mother said, but surely Anna had to roll the tablecloth up wrong side out, just as she's always done. Don't you see, Jensen? It was just a whim on Lisa's part. Then Papa sat down at the table, and they began to lay out the cards, and I sprinkled a few more spices on top of the stove, and Lisa said she wanted to go for a walk. Then I asked if she really wanted to go out in this awful weather, and she said she wasn't afraid of the rain. So I followed her out into the entry and saw to it that she put on her galoshes and raincoat. But I couldn't persuade her to take an umbrella. And then she left. When the poor woman was finished talking, it was as if she died. It was awful to see. I stood up. Well, Jensen, now you've heard about our last evening with Elise, said Landsroot. Can you imagine anything in this peaceful night that would make a young girl want to abandon this life? I couldn't meet his eye. I bowed my head and said goodbye at the door. When she had opened it for me, she came with me down the stairs, past the Olsen's apartment, and out the front steps to the street. Then she took me by the arm and said, for my part, I stopped crying at night a long time ago, and Elise would have too if only she had been patient. But when people say that Lisa was pregnant, then you can tell them from me, Mr. Jensen, that it is a dirty lie, for she drowned nobody but herself. I came down here to the club and had a good stiff whiskey and a soda. I'm just telling what happened. But thoughts, they are strange things. I too, have come to the conclusion that there was a criminal. And drinking doesn't shake that idea from my head. A good home, irreproachable, one might say. But when they found her, Elise was actually smiling. A mystery, yes. But one is free to ponder. It was written in the beginning of the 30s. So, there you have it. How about some immediate reactions before we go back over those questions? How do you feel?
I feel like a lot of my relatives have been paraded in front of my eyes.
Oh dear. Yes. Yeah, I think there is some of that for some of us. Are they all your favorite relatives?
They're all I got.
Anybody else have a reaction?
I'm just a little bit angry. Just a little bit angry that she had to die, or felt she had to take her life, if that's what happened, to be able to make a decision on her own and change her life. Mm-hmm. Changing her everyday routine filled life.
Mm-hmm.
That there why couldn't there have been another way for her? Why did she feel that was the only choice?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see anything. Just you.
She was 30 in one day. And her sister was how old?
40.
And the mother called them her little girls, and the father called them his girls. At what point do you finally grow up?
Dysfunctional family, right? Like what they say nowadays.
That's a very modern term, isn't it? Yes, right. It's pretty impressive, actually. What do you think of what is?
Every family is dysfunctional nowadays.
Yeah, it is. It's certainly the jargon. Well, how is it dysfunctional?
Oh, I don't know. If you're 30 and your mother called, they call them your little girl. growth.
Or 40.
Yeah. Not having grown up and gone out from this sort of small world. And it's a way of being dysfunctional, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Or nuts.
Or nuts. Well, somebody was nuts.
Yeah.
They obviously didn't know each other, Stephen. The communication was probably, you know.
It's also clear within the context of that community, not all that strange, because Jensen didn't seem particularly, he was a little disturbed at the end, but didn't seem to see things as particularly out of whack or particularly different about the whole family. So does, my impression was, this was how it was for many people.
And one of the things that sort of, there's anger, it's maybe for a different reason. Because some of the ways that the family was described are things that I really value. A willingness to do one's duty, a sense of order. But it comes to a situation I don't like. So it's as if it makes it a question that the things that I think are important get used for something that I don't like.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Is it values carried to the extreme then? Kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, maybe that's it.
Well, remember the first description of the father. He's the bank teller, and he precisely takes money in and gives money out and keeps his ledgers, and is and never anything wrong. And if anybody gives him a report that's got one misspelled word, he sends it back.
Yeah. Right.
You'd want that in your bank teller, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd want someone to be precise in that way. People in the office are afraid of him, she says, and yet he's described as being kind. The first paragraph, I'm wondering, Linda, about what you said about the narrator, if he is, what really does he think? In this first paragraph, he starts, "I stopped by the day after the funeral. I felt it was my duty." So he was doing his duty. We've known each other since childhood. And so there was some human reason for that. And then he's the godfather to the dead girl, a woman. We don't have to call her a girl. And he's been worked with this man, with Torvald, for 25 years. And then he says, people in the office are afraid of him. What is there about him? There he sits in his glass cage, taking in money, paying out money, orderly in the extreme. And then he says, he'll return an account for the least error in spelling. One small letter has toppled greater men than I, he says. And it's true, isn't it? Asks the narrator. We have to give him credit, don't we? Asks the narrator. The narrator's not sure about this.
There's a little irony to the whole thing that he sees, the narrator sees many things that are admirable about the man and even about the family, but he also sees the consequence of it. And it's one of the other things that really strikes me is that the father belongs to the free church. It's like he has this one thing that he does that you're not supposed to do. And even there, he's the elder.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you don't see any place for the daughters and the mother to do one thing they're not supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. The two daughters each got freedom through illness in some extent. The older daughter, Anna, went away. The only time she's ever been away from home, she went to a sanitarium 20 years ago. And the younger daughter, Elise, got to take a walk around the church every evening for her headache. So they're both using ill health as a way of having a tiny crack at some point in their life. And then they say, I've actually brooded over it many times. You know, why don't people like this man at work or trust him? It must be the eyes. Clear, blue, unblinking, expressionless eyes. I've tried to meet that gaze. I have nothing to hide, but I can never look him straight in the eye. He's so damn spotless, and damned spotless are in special print. They're emphasized. Landsrud is, you see, and he knows it. So the narrator's really hammering home this guy's nature to us. And he talks about his starched collar and his conscientiousness and stuff. So my first reaction was anger, and my first reaction was anger at him, at Landsrud. On rereading, I sort of moved off that some. What do you think? Is Landsrud bad? Is he all bad? Is he the evil character? Is he the criminal?
He doesn't need anybody, and so everyone is at a distance from him.
Well, but he needs the mother and the daughters to make his world, but he doesn't. He needs them in a real polished way.
Embroidered.
Yeah, more embroidered. Yeah, he needs to be in control in his job as well as his family.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was kind of typical of how women, the place of women in those days. I mean, that's many women, well, of course, are still in that position maybe in places in the world where they just don't have much to say about what goes on.
Well, the farms that I visited around North Dakota, in Minnesota, when I was a kid, it certainly rings true. There's, you know, people I knew. The three women embroidered every surface in that house, because that's all they did in the evening was embroider. And he ruled the roost. He read the newspaper and smoked his pipe, and they weren't allowed to speak because he was reading. So they listened to the rain on the window this night. And he liked, I mean, this...
But he saw that role in a way that he was providing for them. He and God were providing this beautiful home for the whole family. I mean, it wasn't as if he was, you know, that they were serving him. I mean, he felt that there was a common... that they were mutually, providing this home. I don't think he saw it. The Lancer saw it as a dictatorship.
What strikes me is it's a comment. The story is a comment. You know, literature is always an exaggeration in a sense. It's a comment on the austerity of being irreproachable. He was the keeper of the austere irreproachability that the author hammers home so much about. And in that sense, it's a comment, I think, on the whole culture, the whole feel, whether you're a woman or a man, but the whole feel of being a part of that world where everything just hit. And then the Olsons, where they were playing the phonograph late at night, you know, I thought that was great. The little breaking out, we would never consider. Who knows what they were doing at that time?
He had very strong words to say about the police have been here, Landsrud said. Are we to be spared nothing? We have been questioned. The rumors have done their work. We were asked if there was a man in Elise's life. Right. In Elise's life, he again emphasizes Elise's. In Elise's life, Jensen, in my daughter's life, they questioned Anna too. Why would it be so shocking to him, the idea that his 40-year-old or 30-year-old daughter would have a man in her life? Somehow it was. I mean, I think that's at the root of the dysfunctional stuff in the family, is that he was so intent on keeping those girls, those women, as girls, as children in his home, serving his... The children paid rent, room and board, and that they lived there. They had no option to go pay room and board somewhere else, presumably. And then they were sat in silence in the evening. And
the narrator's a bachelor too, isn't he? So he seems a little perplexed by how all this is working out. In other words, he doesn't have a family of his own to compare it with. Mm-hmm. So he's saying, is that right? And he seems to be asking, like, this doesn't seem quite right, but maybe it is.
help me.
With his bachelorhood, maybe he was kind of wondering.
He asked enough questions and we get a pretty clear idea that he thinks something was a little awry. Mm-hmm. And he concludes by saying there was a crime committed.
Mm-hmm. You know, three times he repeats, "I did it out of duty." Not once, but three times I caught that. The mm-hmm. reason he went to him was duty, not compassion or really caring, but duty. Mm-hmm. Duty is a poor driver. Sometimes, mm-hmm. I don't know if it's ever should be the only driver to do something, or the impetus or whatever.
Duty. Right. Yeah, there was something we didn't like about that. He had a clear duty, and I mean, if you had that relationship with anybody, you would of course go. If you'd been friends since childhood and was the godfather to the child. But
a woman wrote the story.
A woman wrote the story. Mm-hmm. The good characteristics that I can find of the father are that he did join the Free Church and therefore made a decision and a choice and didn't follow. I mean, he had some independence of thinking, and it's interesting that the author tells us that. And then he did have tears in his eyes when they started reviewing the litany of things that had happened the night before, and they could remember every sentence that had been said in that room and everything they had done, because it was so orderly, I suppose. But he had tears in his eyes, and he'd gone out and searched for his daughter. I mean, he cared. He was concerned, obviously. He didn't ever get it. I think that's what I resented, was he never understood how horrible that life is. So the story is called A Crime. Do you think that's the right name for the story? Okay, what's the crime?
That he didn't give the freedom to his family to let them go out. It seems like you say, he kept them under his hands, and that they didn't have the freedom to go out into the world on their own. They had to have an excuse, like you say, for sickness or something. Like we today, our families are, we invite our children to grow up and have their own life, but he didn't seem to allow that. And I think that was a crime.
Maybe he was just a product of home, too. I mean, more or less.
Overprotective.
A small place, small town.
I question why two young girls, both of them, why they would not feel they could leave.
I couldn't figure it out.
Why would they stay in that situation?
And then the 40-year-old one said that she'd quit crying at night long ago, and if the 30-year-old had been patient, she eventually would have quit crying at night, too.
This was in 1930?
I think about 35. It doesn't tell exactly, but from what I can figure out.
If it was written then, the conditions were, if you had food and a job, you could, you know, give your family that, but you need to do something that a lot of people couldn't. Mm-hmm. To other people, maybe in the community, were having a worse time. Mm-hmm. Even just feeding people in the family.
That makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense.
Because he would be proud of being able to do those things.
Mm-hmm. He was really a product of what his culture valued. And as you said, he was a victim as much as the women of the values that he was given. Mm-hmm. He probably overdid it, but as in all, you know, women-men conflicts, it's not always just the man who's the victim, sometimes the man is also, because he doesn't really understand the big picture as it should be. He's just a product.
Right, and I think that brings us to the question of what is the big picture and how does the big picture affect us now? Who are we as a result of, if this is some of our heritage, those of us who are Scandinavians or Northern Europeans, I mean, that particular time of the Depression is one thing, and I think that does still affect us all. But is the value in our lives so much on being orderly and spare and precise? And, I mean, last night in the dining hall we had chili, which is a southern dish and a non-Scandinavian dish, and they had a Scandinavian alternative. Did you hear them announce that? And the Scandinavian alternative up at the table was spiceless chili. And the cook came up with a fairly straight face and announced that. You know, the Scandinavian alternative chili is up on the table. So,
experience with people complaining about the spices.
Well, this summer there is a British woman who's the head cook, and she's been trying to use more spices, and she's this is her first summer at Holden, and she's experimenting more. And many, many people at Holden are very thrilled and delighted. But they've had some complaints. You know, this is not Scandinavian food. You're using odd things. In addition to salt and pepper. I mean, is that a metaphor for our lives? Is that what we've inherited? If the village were to fill up tomorrow or the next day with lots and lots of Hispanic and Black folks, there will not be lots and lots. There'll be a few, but I mean, there'll be 30 or 40 maybe. But in other years, they have just thought the food was incredibly bland. And the David's made them crazy. They've written letters to the Safeway in Chelan to try to get hot sauce sent up, you know. Get it helicoptered in. You know, is there something about our heritage as Scandinavians that is pathologically spare or plain or simple or tight or unemotional? Or repressive of women, or
no. I don't think we can change. Why should we?
Why to improve?
I mean, we are what we are. And to try and, I mean, it doesn't hurt to experiment, but we can. I don't think we can change. Because we've been doing this so long, and it's just, this is all it is.
In some ways, I think I noticed some of this more in communities in this country. Some of this, more of this attitude left over than I noticed where I grew up.
That's a very interesting comment.
Because it was more sort of isolated communities coming from some of these isolated places. And it held there longer, maybe, in some ways. Because I noticed some of these attitudes way back when I came into churches in this country that I didn't recognize from my home.
But we all do it in the name of being Norwegian or Scandinavian or something.
Yeah, it's probably
and the original is free to grow and change and become. And well, this book is interesting because it's chronological. The stories are chronological, and so the end of the book is the contemporary stories, and they're pretty wild, and the people in them are pretty wild and crazy in some ways, and they do really different kinds of things. I think they deal with the same set of roots, but there is some real change. I find when I go from Chicago back to my hometown, Moorhead, Minnesota, that I remember things about how to behave that just snap on. It's like turning on a light in me. The things that I don't do in Chicago and ways I don't act. I have changed over the years, having left Moorhead and grown away from Trinity Lutheran Church in Moorhead. But I go back there and I can immediately resume all of those attitudes and ways of dressing and ways of talking and everything. I mean, it comes right back to me. So there's some change that's gone on. I recently took my parents to a Indian restaurant in Chicago, and they did fine. I told them chef to tone down the spices as far down as they could go. And
well,
my family. Yeah.
But the thing too is, can we accept the change like in short term, or can we accept it
for others as being okay too. I mean, but at the same time realizing that we do have our own values.
So what are you proud of? What are you, yeah, what stories can you tell? What are you proud of about being, about your Scandinavian heritage? What's good about it?
I shouldn't have worn this today.
Well, I'm very proud of it, and I'm very happy with it.
It's a joke, but I mean, I like to work, and it's just for fun. This is one that says, life's too short not to be Norwegian. But I mean, I got it in Ballard, you could buy it that said Swedish or Finnish or Dane. I mean, I just happened to have some Norwegian. So it's a fun thing.
So what's good about your heritage?
That I like Lefse. It's one of the best ones. The fact that she and I took a trip 4 years ago and went to Norway, to be able to, that was really emotional for me, just to really be in the country where my mom's family came from.
Can you give Gertrude?
Well, I'm Scandinavian background, but I'm Swedish background. I think much of it's similar. That it was to show power in control. And this is why it was very rude and impolite to show your emotions. You know, not to display grief or anger, was that you were in control. And we have a hard time to get over that. Mm-hmm. See, and that's part of what makes a family dysfunctional. You don't have any release. And that begins to show up after a while. But I'm one, I just can't do it, you know. It's just been so ingrained in me to be this way. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very hard. At the same, it's what we were taught from way back. And to be thrifty and save and to keep everything because you might need it, you know. Thrifty was honorable. And you just never get away from something like that. Another thing that was hard to get over. Oh yeah. Well, even what's his name that wrote the book said they all became doctors in the family, and finally they wanted their mother to have help. Well, she cleaned up the house before the help came, you know. They never changed that. And then he talked about first he had a shirt, and then it became
a vest or something.
Yeah, a vest, and it went down to an apron and a towel and an apron and then a bib. You know, I mean it was. Very end.
Is that why I do that?
Well, and I mean that's, you know, the thriftiness and hard working, and there are a lot of attributes to be proud of.
Right.
And making a success of yourself by
if
being.
We have to go back to simplified lifestyle. We're in much better shape to be able to do that.
That's right.
We grew up without having.
And that's one of the things that. A lot of contemporary urban kids are not being taught,
right,
because of dysfunctional families or poverty or the ravages of poverty mostly. But they're not learning some of the old traditional things. Like a good friend of ours who's a black woman, 65 years old, had all 13 of her children at home births, and knew how to do healthy, safe home births, and had a midwife, and all of her grandchildren and her children and grandchildren have had their babies in hospitals, and there was sickness and problem after problem. Her 13 kids are still now in their 30s and 40s, strong, healthy, beautiful. They were all nursed. They were all, you know, she knew from the South how to feed them. They ate collard greens and beans, and I mean they ate healthy food that was rooted in their culture. And her kids eat Twinkies. You know, there's something about our culture now that separates people from their roots, and it's a very sick thing to do to people. And so insofar as we, I mean, there's an awful lot about our heritage that we can be proud of and feel good about. I think it's also good for us to realize that it's not the only way to do things, and that there are other heritages and other people's roots that are also wonderful. And also I think it's important to realize that there are some ways in which our heritage has been very bad for us. You know, and I think the way that our culture is Northern European people have traditionally treated women is not a way that I would want my daughter to, not a life I'd want my daughter to live in. I wouldn't want her to have been born 200 years ago in Norway, or 100 years ago in Norway. I'm not happy with those kind of controlling ways that families were run. I think that that's unhealthy. and I'm glad my family isn't like that. But I also want her to be thrifty, and I want her to be resourceful, and I want her to be tidy, and I want her to do her homework on time and hand it in, and you know. And all of those things are things that we were all taught, I think. So I guess one of the things that I've learned in living in a place where I'm not the majority, and I'm a sort of fish out of sea, is that there are lots of things about my background that are good, and I value, and I'm proud of, and happy about, and I love Lefse.
Where did the Norwegians with their sense of humor, where did they creep out from under the rocks or the sea or something? Because I have known some Norwegians who have just fantastic sense of humor, love to joke and stuff. How did they evolve out of this austere background?
Well, I'd imagine it wasn't all austere, huh?
I don't know.
There's a Norwegian from Norway. You can ask her.
Yeah.